You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with Christopher Stackhouse. Christopher, thanks so much for being with me today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Let's talk about what you're working on now. I want to talk about your whole practice, but let's just jump into perhaps what you're writing now or what you're currently involved in.
Well, at the moment, I'm working on a few pieces. I'm writing a catalog essay for an artist named Susan McClellan. I am working on a book that's based on an essay I wrote about an exhibition of the text work of the artist Jean-Michel Basquiat. That was actually, I think, just closed at the Brooklyn Museum. I wrote an essay for that catalog, and through doing some research and kind of comparing Jean-Michel Basquiat's writing to other poets and other artists who used text in a way that was literary or poetic or kind of based in a kind of conceptual mode that straddles art and writing, I've decided to write a book about Jean-Michel's use of text, recasting him as a literary figure, as an avant-garde literary figure of the post-war era, situating him between various schools of poetics, the language school, New York school, and the Black Arts Movement. And then I'm working on two volumes of poetry, one called And You Should Have This Pleasure, which is basically a long kind of treatment on love and the kind of the fetish quality of love and how that might apply to the way that we look at art, so the way that we fetishize and love certain works of art, and the kind of irrationality behind our affection for art, and also the kind of irrationality that is concomitant with love in relationships and the objects of our affection, which includes our kids and our lovers and wives and husbands and the people in our lives. And then the other volume is called In Parts, which is a long it's actually a book of discrete poems, but I basically rotate, kind of cycle through phrases and texts, and it's also a lot about love and affection and attraction and the erotic in art and the erotic in everyday life and the eye and how the eye informs the mind, which informs the mouth, and then there's a lot of musical play in it, and all of the sections are all eight octets, so they're all eight lines. I'm kind of taking off of the ballade or various eight-line structures, eight-line forms in poetry. That's pretty much it for the writing, is what it's most pressing. And I'm writing something that was supposed to be a short review, but it's turning into a longer treatment on the collection SOS Poems 1961 to 2013 by Amiri Baraka, which I'm really appreciating Baraka a lot more than I ever have when he was alive, which is sad. But that's what I'm working on now. Those are some of the things that I'm working on.
Let's talk a little bit more about what you're doing with Basquiat, because to me that's kind of fascinating. I mean, these are all interesting, and we could move into a lot of areas, but, because you're a poet and understanding it from that angle, it sounds to me, and I want you to just talk more about it and explain about it, that the book you're writing about him is almost a kind of revisionist way of looking at his work and putting him within a literary context that he hasn't been seen before. And that's fascinating and wonderful and a great thing for, as I see it, a writer and historian to do. What brought you into that? And can you tell me a little bit about that? Because I don't really know his work that way or his text work that way. Can you tell me what made you suddenly get so involved in thinking about his place in the literary world?
Well, I mean, you know, I came to Basquiat, you know, as a much younger person, and when I first encountered the work, I didn't understand it. I was really quite attracted to it, just naturally. No one had informed me that he was a great star back in the 80s. You know, I was a kid then, so I didn't see, you know, I'd moved to New York. I wasn't so much involved in, art that was produced out of that era at the time. But over time, I started to look at it, and I also started to draw and try to incorporate my writing into my drawing. And then that's when I kind of started to understand that there was a poetic sensibility, a writerly sensibility, that the writer's head was informing his work. I didn't have a chance to or any outlet for really talking about it with anyone. But until I went to this writer's retreat called Avicanum, into the was a writer's retreat for African-American writers. And while there, I started to just kind of experiment with writing poems that looked like some of the text works and drawings of Jean Michel's. And shortly thereafter, a poet named Kevin Young produced a book that emulated Jean Michel's text. And I kind of liked it, and I kind of didn't like that book. And then I started, but it did make me look at Jean Michel's writing again more closely and to see, what were some of the poetic effects that were being employed in the work that went beyond just the purely visual aspects of the writing and text use. As time went on, I ended up writing a book review of a book called Everybody's Goodbye Ain't Gone, which is a collection of African-American avant-gardist poetry put together by Alden Nielsen and Laurie Ramey. And in that review, I talked about the book and, you know, some of the writers that were missing from the book, that I thought were missing from the book, that could be associated with avant-garde, you know, mid, late 20th century avant-garde writing. And in the review, I included Jean-Michel Basquiat among many other names, Douglas Kearney, John Keane, Latasha Diggs, a bunch of different people. That was the first time I actually kind of inserted him in a public way in a piece of writing, saying like he should be also thought of as an avant-garde writer. And then skipping ahead a couple of years ago, Trisha Lachlan Bloom and Dieter Buchart were putting together the show at the Brooklyn Museum, and Trisha called me and just said, "Hey, you're a poet based in Brooklyn." She was kind of talking around it, but she was like, "You know, you're African American, you're in Brooklyn. We'd love it if you would write something about Jean Michel as a writer." Coming at his work from the point of view of a poet. And then she explained what the exhibition was about and what it entailed, what was going to be in it. And I said, "Yeah, okay, I'll do it." And so they had a very, very short turnaround period. They called me in February. They wanted first draft in April for a 5,000-word piece plus notes. And I didn't make the deadline. I ended up turning.
Yeah, I was going to say, wow, nothing like a deadline. But
there's no way I was going to be able to make that. I said yes. I ended up turning in the final copy in June, but in the 4 months later, which is, I talked to David Levi Strauss, and he told me, he's like, that's crazy that they would ask you to do that, but I did it. He's like, usually get it a year, 10 months or so, to do something like that. But anyway, I did it in 4 months. And I've immersed myself in, one, in their research library at the museum, And then I realized that I had tons of essays and reviews and text pieces and things that no one had, you know, really looked at together about his work. And then I just, as I amassed all of this research material, sounds like a lot more than it is, but, you know, it's a few thousand pages of stuff. And I was like, whoa, there's potential here. And then I aligned him in the essay with the poet Bob Kaufman and Norman Pritchard, Norman H. Pritchard. And, I mean, I can talk about who they are and why I find them germane to Basquiat. But one of the things that was interesting in using Kaufman in particular is that Kaufman was a friend of Raymond Foy. And Raymond Foy is a, you know, he's kind of an art dealer, sort of. He's an art person, really. And he did a collection called The Ancient Rain of Bob Kaufman. It was published in 1981. And right around the same time, he had started this press called Hanuman Books with Francesco Clemente. And just so happens, I thought to myself, I was like, well, you know, if Foy was working with Kaufman and Clemente at that time, I wonder if he had ever met Jean-Michel, and had Jean-Michel been familiar with Bob Kaufman. So I basically guessed that they would have been. And Kaufman has a poem, which I have to look it up again, but refers to a kid who's on heroin who's the new, not Baudelaire, but the new French surrealist kid on the block or whatever. And I don't know if that poem is about Basquiat or not, but I thought it was interesting because it, you know, kind of made a sketch of Basquiat, well, at least the sketch that the public view, you know, could understand or would have understood. And then I saw this relationship between their work. So it just so happens, a few months ago, I met Raymond Foy, and we become friends and, you know, talk occasionally. And he said, yeah, I gave Jean-Michel copies of Bao's books back in the day. And I was like, wow. And I said, did they ever meet? And he said, they might have, but he wasn't totally sure, but he had definitely given them text. So that was just a moment of happenstance, of luck, you know, to find that out. And then I realized that this young man was really connected to an entire, probably two generations of artists and writers, not just as friends, and not just in terms of digesting the material. He was kind of a voracious reader and thinker and absorbing everything. But in terms of the kind of zeitgeist, he had a head that was a mindset that was very open and receiving to information that I don't think he was fully aware that he was always receiving. And I decided from that point that I would just, you know, kind of pursue mining this area of his output to kind of reconfigure it, revise his artistic story to include him as a literary figure.
And what kind of text did you have for research? Like, what have you been going through? Did he leave poems, text pieces? I mean, it sounds like, you know, there's, when you talk about it, my only association is really kind of poetry, concrete or something with his work. But what kind of text have you read by him? Well, what's the variety of things he's left behind? It's fascinating, that story of that insight into what he was reading to and involved in. Such an amazing kind of insight.
Well, there's a bunch of stuff. I mean, the show, did you see the show?
I haven't seen that show yet, but that'll be listed in here, and this interview will be up, so most people listening to this will be able to see it if it's up now.
It's up. It's traveling. I don't know where it's going to be next, but it is traveling. And I think it's closed now. It might still be up. Well, in their research library, they basically had maybe a dozen or so monographs. They had some magazines and some photocopies of reviews and articles. So I went through all of those. I actually hand-copied about half a dozen of the monographs, just the text, not the images. I have several monographs here. So there were those, and then there were things that they didn't have, like Robert Hughes's Requiem for Featherweight, which is a, you know, kind of a takedown, a posthumous takedown of Jean-Michel Basquiat and all of his supporters, written by Hughes and published in Nothing, if not Critical, a collection of his reviews and essays. And so, they didn't have that. I made a copy of that and added it to their library, to their research section. And then there's just a ton of writing that I got from, you know, various rags. There's an old rag, New York rag, called A. Rude that had a piece on him. People are constantly writing about him.
But what about his writings? Did you also look through texts of his that he left? I mean, we just his poems or writings or notes or scribbles or manuscripts is what I'm thinking about.
Yeah. I gave for the essay, I gave an exegetical reading of two texts of his. I think it was two. Two texts. Or one text, kind of in full poem, and then some sections of poems that kind of came up throughout the piece. The show basically took those Marvel notebooks that he carried around, those little kind of school notebooks. They dismantled one of the books, several of them actually, according to the specs of the owner of the pieces and the museum curators, and they took the books apart, and they just showed, they showed text from the notebooks. Just they took the books apart completely, very delicately, took them apart, and then framed them. And so the exhibition basically looks at discrete pages of text from his actual notebooks. And before I started working on it, the museum gave me a stack maybe four or five or six notebooks, discrete notebooks that were just photocopies of text from them. So there, I got to look at fragments and things that could actually function as poems. Lots of vignettes, like he would sit at a cafe and then just see something and then like write it out as a story, like about a homeless person or about a woman passing by, or any kind of observation that struck him, he would write these little, really what we would call now flash fiction, or just quite simply vignettes. It's flash fiction, whatever, but then little short bits of stories. And some of them came to a conclusion, and some of them were just kind of observations. And then he would also employ this listing as a strategy for creating texts. And they were, some of them are brilliant. Some of them are just really, really funny. And then there's something that's consistent in all of the writing, whether it be these short bits of, three-word phrases or a series of lists or lines. Or a complete or, kind of a comprehensive whole that could function as a discrete text, be it as a poem or a short story, the consistent theme or, the consistent attitude in Jean-Michel's writing is critical. It's critical of capitalism. It's critical of the kind of society that he's seeing. It's a very close read of wealth disparity, essentially, and a conflict around his own kind of pursuance of wealth and power, and at the same time understanding that in order to achieve that, he would become the enemy of the common people, of the poor. And he was straddling these places. Now, he wasn't a poor kid, obviously. The stories are, it sounds redundant to say it, but I'll say it anyway. He was a middle-class, black kid, from Brooklyn. Now, that's also complicated, and it's also something that runs through the work, too, is that he's Puerto Rican and he's Haitian. and he's choosing to identify as African American, as Black American. And part of that too is he sees that space as a platform, a forum, a powerful platform and forum from which to give critique to Western society, and particularly neoliberal capitalism as it was in full throttle in the 1980s. I mean, it's still going at the same pace, but I think the introduction, the reintroduction of neoliberal, fiscal policy and its effects on society were strikingly amped up in the 80s, and he's sitting there watching it. And he's conditioned by his father, who's an accountant, to pursue money and to pursue an upper middle class lifestyle, and he hates it. And at the same time, his tastes, his abilities, I mean, he speaks three languages, he didn't go to college, but he self-taught, he took the art world, kind of by the tail in a way, as a very young man. He's a brilliant kid. So, the thing is like, how is he dealing with this conflict? And, of at once hating the thing that he's built to pursue, and that, in essence, he kind of comes from.
Yeah. I mean, that's fascinating, because I think a lot of artists were dealing with that at this time. I mean, I was also, middle-class kid from Yonkers. I remember in 1986, I was graduating from an art school, SUNY Purchase, and that was right around the time, maybe it was 85, when he was, I wouldn't say at the zenith of his fame, but he was in the New York Times wearing an Armani suit that was kind of covered in paint. And for artists at that time, I remember thinking in a conflicting way, I would like that, And at the same time, I'm coming from a school, that art school at that time anyway, which is very critical of means of production and capitalism and everything else. So there was this conflict, even upon graduating as an artist, of I would like what he has, but it also looks terribly commercial and all about feeding the means of production of this, crushing capitalist system. So it was, I think for a number of artists, you graduate, and perhaps I'm reaching here, but that's how it strikes me, that the zeitgeist of that time was, how do we stay true to ourselves as artists and even have, adopt kind of the most liberal or left point of views and still want to what now would be referred to as be part of the 1% and wear Armani suits while painting with, Andy Warhol or something.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, it's in the essay, one of the people that I refer to who was an artist alive back then is Lawrence Weiner. And, there's a pointed moment in the very beginning of the essay that I wrote for the monograph, that just, talks about Weiner's, distaste, for the rich and for, the elite, not elitism, but the elite. And I align it with Basquiat. And I saw Weiner at the dinner. There's a big dinner for the opening in April at the Brooklyn Museum. And it was, Peter was there. And, just like it's for the trustees and the people involved with the show and whatever. And Trisha said, Lawrence wants to meet you. And I had never met him. And we met very briefly. And he said, look, I was a working class Jew from the Bronx. And when I saw what this kid was doing, it was so much so different from what I was doing. But I loved and appreciated the work, and I also found it. I found kinship in his use of text and how he was using it. And they both had this kind of political edge on it. And so, to agree with you, I think many many artists have that conflict and still do have that conflict of. In order to survive as an artist, you have to have a certain amount of means. In order to be an artist, you have to have elitist tendencies. How do you reconcile this mining from the culture to attain a certain amount of privilege and wealth that's necessary in order to produce? That's an ongoing conflict. And it's for this kid, it's one of the things that people don't talk about, but it's riddled through his text. It's like, you know, a constant treatment of the socio-political throughout his text. And that's what was is most attractive to me, and that's kind of what I want to deal with in my writing about him.
It's just fascinating to hear about this. I'm so glad you are doing the writing about him. In closing, I want to have links in here so that people will read your poetry, and I'd love people to get this book as well, learn more about everything we're talking about. I want to thank you for talking with me today, but in closing, is there anything else you want to say about just that subject? Because while I'd like to ask you more questions on it, it's sort of a rabbit hole, but the idea of this conflict that artists have about, just as Basquiat was struggling with it, maybe in closing, how did he resolve that, do you think, or was it ever resolved?
I don't think it ever was resolved. Maybe we could call the resolution his suicide, accidental suicide, or, I think most people, when they find themselves, when they look at life and see that there is no real way out of this, you have to go through it. There's no way of escaping the pain. We do little things just kind of slowly diminish our lives. We smoke too much, we drink too much, we have bad sexual habits or too much sex, or we do drugs, or we lament, or at a certain point you kind of give up. And if you're really spiritually sound, you try to work your way through it. You try to think through it, and you try to come, understand that there's a wholeness in life, and you kind of find your lane. And you make your best contribution so that it's a little easier for the generation before you. And closing, I guess I'll say that I don't think it's resolved. I think it's very open. And I think in part, not that it was his intention, but I think his work has presented and still presents lots of questions about Western art, about history, about race, about class, about our socioeconomic situation, and it begs us to continue to think about what these things mean to us and what they mean to the existence of all of us, all human beings. He's a humanist.
Christopher, thanks so much for talking with me today. I really appreciate your time.
It's my pleasure.
You're listening to Yale Radio WIBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.